Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 85 of the Let's Talk Yoga podcast. I hope you are doing well. On the show today, I have a very enriching episode, and I'm so excited to share this conversation with you. But before we get to that, I'd like to make a very important announcement. June 10th, my Teaching Yoga to Beginners course is launching. Now, this course is created for yoga teachers who want to improve and sharpen their skill of teaching beginners yoga. Now, beginners yoga is truly an underserved market in the yoga world. In fact, what most yoga teachers don't realize is that you can take a beginner and then grow their practice and walk them through different phases and stages of yoga. And essentially, you can create a lifelong connection with your yoga student and see how yoga can really transform them. A lot of you know my story. I came here as an immigrant and I started with zero students. And I grew Aham Yoga from zero students to what it is today, one beginner at a time. And as I met students who had to grow in their practice, I had to grow. And so essentially what I started doing was I started problem solving and creating sequences and testing things and tweaking things and came up with a program for beginners that really works. Okay. And I've taken this decades work and put it into this course. And I'm so excited at how it's turned out. It's going to be so valuable for any yoga teacher who wants to create greater, deeper, and stronger impact with beginners and help more beginners take on yoga practice and stick to it and feel successful in it. Now, the course is starting on June 10th, which is less than 30 days away as you're listening to this episode. All the details for this course are available at mindfulyogateachers.com/beginnersYTT. It's happening only once this year. It is completely virtual, and I have kept almost every time zone in mind as I've scheduled this. So you can again find all the details at mindfulyogateachers.com/beginnersYTT. Replays are available. You also have a big bank of summary videos, so you don't have to scroll on Zoom replays forever. There are alumni sessions, there's a checklist, there are manuals, there are sample sequences. Again, I have done all the work to make sure that you learn in a really smart and efficient way. So the beginner is helped at the end of all of this. Okay. So I really hope you will join me in this training. Again, mindfulyogateachers.com/beginnersYTT. And there's also an information session that I will be hosting soon. And I'll tell you more about that in next week's episode. Just make sure you are on my email list so you don't miss any updates about this. All right. Now, moving on to today's show. Now, on the show today, I have Anvita Dixit, and I'm so excited to introduce you to her because I recently stumbled upon her work. Anvita Dixit has an exhaustive YouTube channel called Yogic Gurukul, and she has the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, all the sutras, video by video, explained and broken down beautifully and made really digestible for people like you and me to understand the sutras. So that's what really got me connected with Anvita. Anvita has grown up in India and she grew up at the Kaivalya Dham Yoga Center. And her father has been working there for a very long time. And that's how she grew up in the yoga center. And she was trained by some of the best teachers and in the classical forms of yoga. And from a very young age, she's learned asana, pranayama, meditation, and philosophy. She has been teaching for several years, both in India and abroad, and she caters to a very wide audience. And the reason I got her on the show today is so that you can hear her depth of wisdom when it comes to understanding and embodying the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. And I hope that you will explore her channel, Yogic Gurukul, after you listen to this conversation. We talk about so many things about the Yoga Sutras, starting with who is Patanjali? How do we address Patanjali? Okay. What are the Yoga Sutras? What is a sutra? What should you as a student be aware of when you're opening the sutras. How should you study these sutras? And then Anvita tells us five most important sutras that we should know from this text. Okay. She also talks about her inspiration behind starting her YouTube channel, and there's so much more. I'm really excited that she's on the show. I hope to have her back for more conversations. So enjoy today's episode. I will see you on the other side. Hi, my name is Arundhati, and you're listening to the Let's Talk Yoga podcast. I'm an ex-Bollywood dancer turned yoga and wellness educator. I've built a six-figure business as an immigrant, woman of color yoga teacher with no business background, no handstands, pure instinct, and the free information found on Google. If you love doing yoga and you dream of teaching it someday, this podcast is for you. We go over everything from doing and teaching yoga to scaling a small business, living a modern yoga lifestyle, and so much more. You'll find interesting, fun, raw conversations along with some tips, tricks, strategies, and insights in this podcast. So grab your cup of chai and let's jump in. Hi, Anvita. Welcome to the Let's Talk Yoga podcast.
Hey, Arunati. Thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
I'm excited to connect. I can't believe we haven't connected sooner than this.
I know.
So just to give the listeners a heads up of what we're going to be talking about, we're going to be taking a deep dive into Maharishi Patanjali and the Yoga Sutras. And this came about because of your YouTube channel, which we'll talk about later in the episode. And that's how I got to connect with you. So to kick things off, Anvita, can you tell us who was Patanjali? And can you tell us a little more about his life? Because largely Patanjali is mysterious.
That's such a good question. And I think that I hope I can do some justice to the answer to it. But I think mostly what we do know is that he was an Indian sage, truly par excellence, because he was able to give us an idea of yoga, Ayurveda, as well as Sanskrit grammar. So it seems to be that he was somebody that encapsulated knowledge on all these different topics. And his most important work, of course, is the Patanjali Yoga Sutras. Now, most academics say that he was, you know, probably lived between 200 to 500 BCE. And he was somebody that had a lot of experience and understanding of the human mind, which is why he was able to expound so well about how human mind functions, what kind of thoughts we have, and how to deal with them. But I have to say that not a lot is known exactly about his life, where he lived, where he grew up, where he was from. And I think that is because a lot of, you know, Indian sages at the time were very used to not accrediting the work to themselves and their personal lives. So I think he tended to, you know, have the prescription of Patanjali, but it was not necessarily all just one person. A lot of people think that the Ayurveda texts and even the work on Sanskrit grammar could have been different people who attributed it to the name Patanjali. So it's something that is highly debated and something that academics and historians are still trying to figure out. But from my end, I will say that from the school of thought that I come from, we regard him as almost, you know, God incarnated. We often refer to him as Bhagwan Patanjali and really have a lot of reverence for him and his work. So facts aside, I think that in terms of faith and belief in his ideology, I think that's 100%. And he's somebody that we can only aspire to be like in this lifetime.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's something you said which I just want to pause on. You spoke about how a lot of these people who went deeply into yoga study, they never brought up their own personal life in these conversations. It's a parallel to modern yoga, right? Because a lot of modern yoga, the teacher is such an important, not important part, but just such a visible part of that conversation. And sometimes I feel like we get lost in the modern yoga world. It's more about the teacher and less about the yoga. And I'm glad you brought that up. There's no question here. I'm just calling out that grad. I'm glad you brought that up. So how does one really address Patanjali? Okay. Is it Bhagwan Patanjali, Maharishi Patanjali, or just Patanjali?
Very good question. I think that it comes from the way that we feel, I think, about the text and about Patanjali. But I think the best way to refer to him from a neutral standpoint is definitely Maharishi Patanjali. It's the most neutral and the right way to go for a beginner, especially. But I think over time, when you're studying the text, I think, because I've studied this with my teacher for the last 10 years, so it's been a very long time. And I think for me, over time, I've just developed so much reverence that it's become Bhagwan Patanjali. And I think that happens to a lot of people as they go deeper into the text. But in general, I think Maharishi Patanjali is a pretty good way to refer to, you know, Muni Patanjali. And just saying just Patanjali sometimes I think can be a little casual. So I try to suggest that we go with, you know, Maharishi or Muni Patanjali just because of how revered he is and the kind of work he did.
Got it. Thank you for that. So what are the Yoga Sutras?
I think that the Yoga Sutras essentially to me are this excellent body of work on the mind and psychology. And I say this because it's amazing how deep he's gone into the psychology of a human being, how a human being develops from one stage to another, what tools can be used to take you from point A to point B. And sometimes it seems like, you know, we overemphasize the asana, the pranayama, and the Ashtanga yoga element of that comes from the Yoga Sutras. But I think that we overlook that majority of the work is based on a psychological understanding. So I think that for me and the kind of school of thought that we come from, it's mostly a psychological text that helps a yoga sadhak to purify his or her mind and enables him or her to restrain the thought waves in a way that takes your mind more towards samadhi so that you can go towards self-realization. So I think that's the overall aim of the text and what it was written with the intention of. But very often, I think we get stuck on the second chapter, you know, which talks about the sadhana path.
So true.
And Ashtanga. So yeah, I would say it's more psychology.
Got it. No, that really clarifies it. For the listeners, I mean, I know we have some of our listeners who are just getting started on teaching yoga. So can you explain this word sutra?
Definitely. I think that for a beginner, I understand there's so many new words coming up and it can seem a little confusing. So I think the word sutra itself is just referring to a very concise and precise sentence that is mostly written in Sanskrit and that helps us to understand a particular concept. It was done in such a way because at that time we kind of, you know, learned everything verbally. So sages would constantly be learning the sutras verbally and reciting them. So to condense information and make it easy to remember and verbally recite, sutras were formulated. And the rule of the sutra was that the shorter, the better. And the fewer words you use with utmost clarity, the more precise your sutra is. So I feel that is the definition of the sutra. And then also to explain the work on a sutra, there was also bhashyas, which then went into detail and much more, you know, lengthy pages of information on what that precise sentence was talking about. So for beginners that are listening in, I think just remembering that the sutra is like notes, you know, when we had exams, you would make notes and make it really concise. Sutras are kind of like that. And then the bhashya is the exposition on the what, the how, and more details about the sutra.
Yeah, the commentary essentially on the sutra. Yeah. Okay. So I want to go back to Patanjali here for a moment before we jump into the sutras. Can you talk about the form that we see, you know, Maharishi Patanjali being represented today, the half man, half snake type of form? Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, definitely. So very interestingly, the yoga school that I grew up in, the logo of the school is the half man, half snake form of, you know, of the Sheshnag, as we call it. And I think that it's really incredible because, so the story, right, of Muni Patanjali, which is believed by folklore, is that he fell into Anjali's, you know, Pat Anjali, because he fell into her arms as in the snake form, because she was doing a lot of sadhana for a son or a child, and then he fell into her arms like that while she was bathing. So because he fell into her palms, his name became Patanjali. And it is said that he had that half snake, half human form because he wasn't entirely human, and his origins are more from a space of being a demigod or being a god. So therefore, they say that he took on the Sheshnag or the Anantashesh format to come onto this earth and use that to kind of propagate his teachings. And it also goes back to why, you know, snakes and in general, specifically cobras and the Nag is so revered in Hindu philosophy and Indian psychology, because it represents Patanjali and it kind of shows us that that combination of human and snake is something that we bow down towards and something that we really sort of have great reverence for.
So for someone who wants to study the Yoga Sutras, what should they be aware of?
I think for someone that wants to study the Yoga Sutras, they need to kind of, I think the intention with which you come in is the most important thing while studying the sutras. I think a lot of times we approach the sutras because we have it as a subject in our exams, or it's just, you know, told to us that this is the origin of yoga, therefore we need to study it. So sometimes, you know, I've come across students who just see it as one of those compulsory subjects that we just have to look into. But I think that if we go a little bit more beyond that and we look at it as the most fundamental text on yoga, and we look at it as, okay, this text is going to tell me the aim of yoga. It's going to give me the path to yoga. It's also going to tell me certain impacts of yoga, along with a liberation process associated with yoga, then I think we are looking at it in the right holistic approach. Because otherwise, we're just thinking of it as looks like a text that was written several years ago in a language that I don't necessarily understand. So a lot of students, you know, have this approach that this is so difficult. Why is it so tricky? And why is it so challenging? But if we come from a place of this is that one book that's going to give me a holistic understanding of this subject that I already love so much and that I want to dive into, then we can approach it with sincerity and sort of like almost a little bit of a surrender with an open mind that whatever it's going to give us is going to enrich our practice so much more than it already has. And then it becomes a true, I think, you know, devoted practice of learning the sutras. So then when you come in with that intention, even if it's difficult, even if it's challenging, the language is tricky, you overcome those challenges because you know that it will give you certain answers within your practice that you've been searching for.
Well said. How should one learn the sutras? Should they learn it from a teacher? Should they learn it by, you know, reading it themselves? I know your YouTube channel is there to help people who can't find a teacher, but how should one learn the sutras?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think the best way, and I really believe in the Guru Shishya Parampara, you know, that traditional yoga follows. And I think that's honestly the best way. I have to say over here that I wouldn't be able to teach half the things that I'm able to if it were not for my gurus and my teachers who individually taught me these concepts and sat me down through them. So I would highly recommend that if you're able to have access to a teacher, preferably somebody who speaks Sanskrit or at least understands Sanskrit grammar, you know, because I think that a lot of times we don't give enough credit to teachers who are well-versed with the language.
And so true.
Yeah, and I think that's a huge mistake that we make sometimes because the book is in Sanskrit, you know, so it's kind of like it's something we can't skip. We have to look to a teacher who is well versed in that language. And then also somebody who I would say has years of experience and can guide you through even the minute difficulties within the sutras. So for a complete beginner, I would say step number one, if you have decided with the intention that you would like to study this, seek out a teacher that comes from a very strong lineage, a strong background, who can credibly explain the sutras to you. So preferably, I would say somebody who studied Sanskrit. if they're of Indian origin, then that's great because maybe they have a rootedness or a background in the language or they've studied it, but not necessarily because there are a lot of international teachers as well who go deep into the language. So one is that. And then secondly, also to check that the teacher is not fixated on a particular school of thought. So the reason I say this is because you can look at Patanjali's Yoga Sutras in many different ways. You can come from a Sankhya school of thought or Vedanta, or you can look at it from a Nyaya perspective. So if you have a teacher who is fixated only on one school of thought, then it could, you know, almost taint your understanding into one specific field only. But if a teacher is able to give you a more grammatical explanation, something that encapsulates a little bit from all the schools, then I think your understanding becomes more complete. So, and I know, Arundhati, you've said this on your podcast before as well, that the research we do on selecting our yoga teacher is the most important. And
absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's the same here, you know, like just the way you look out for a practical asana yoga teacher, same thing with your philosophy guru. It needs to be somebody that, you know, has extensive knowledge in this field. And once you're able to identify them, then spending a lot of time one-on-one or in small group settings, learning with them. And if, like you said, that's not possible, it's not accessible, then reaching out to, then looking at online resources like, say, YouTube or blogs online, that may help you. But a guru is a must. I really think that.
No, I'm in complete agreement with you here. So, because sometimes right here, especially out here, people will pick up a translation of somebody who's read five translations of some other people who probably have not, do not have a Sanskrit background or any cultural understanding. So we just end up diluting and further confusing ourselves.
Absolutely.
So I'm glad you clarified that. So before we get into how this book is laid out, right? How this text is laid out, can we talk about the different types of yoga seekers? Because I know in our correspondence, you mentioned something about based on the types of seekers who come to study this text. So can you talk a little more about that?
Definitely. So this is one of my favorite topics because I think it helps a yoga sadhak to find the right path within the Yoga Sutras much more quickly. So when we were studying this with my teachers, one method they told us to study the sutras is to look at the type of seeker or sadhak that you have. So there are three main categories, and this also comes within Sutra 1.22 in the Yoga Sutras. The three main categories are Mridu, Madhya, and Adhimatra. So, you know, these are excellent terms because it's talking, in a way, if I had to draw parallels, it's like how in practical classes we say beginner, intermediate, and advanced. It's similar to that, but within the philosophy or more intellectual Gyan Yoga understanding space. So if we look at sadhak from a mridu perspective, where we say, okay, this is a practitioner that's still mild, still quite nascent, still learning, then we take them down a particular path where we start with Kriya Yoga, or you start with the second chapter and help them to understand certain methods or techniques because it's easier for them to grasp that. So the reason Kriya Yoga becomes easy to grasp is because it's just three main components of Tapas, Swadhyaya, and Ishwara Pranidhan. So it's a very easy sort of, you know, one method that you can assign to a beginner and say, hey, master this. And it's short and it's sweet and it's easy to pass on to a beginner practitioner. So we look at it from that perspective for Mridu. Then coming to somebody that is, you know, Madhyam, so in between, so kind of has a good understanding, a good grasp over certain concepts, but still kind of finding their way through the yoga path, such a practitioner would most benefit with the Ashtanga Yoga sequence, again, within the second chapter. So, because that becomes a very practical sadhana path that they can follow. And once they've mastered that, then you take them deeper and deeper into samadhi and philosophies associated with the samadhi and deeper dharana dhyan sections. So, you know, those are the first two levels. And then it's also amazing to see Adhimatra, interestingly, is this a person or a sadhak who is pretty deeply initiated into the practice, has, you know, already gone through maybe certain years of practice, has a deep understanding, that type of a seeker is suggested or recommended to go through the first chapter and adopt practices like Abhyas and Vairagya along with Ishwar Pranidhan. So it's really interesting here how, you know, level one and two practitioners are expected to look at chapter two, but a level three practitioner is expected to look at chapter one. And so it almost seems like, why is there a crossover? You know, why doesn't it start from chapter one itself? And this usually happens because the first chapter is really just laying out the larger aim or long-term vision for the sadhak, for the practitioner. And Muni Patanjali just goes directly into the deepest elements of the yoga philosophy straight away in the first chapter. And then in the second chapter, it's a little more, let me give you the structure now. And it kind of becomes a little more easy to practically understand. So therefore, when we're looking at different seekers or sadhaks and we're thinking, okay, what is the best way for them to understand this text, or what are some of the best ways for them to do this practically? Then you assign it based on this understanding of chapter one and two usually.
Got it. So would this be a good point in our conversation to actually jump into the sutras themselves?
Yes, this is perfect.
Okay, wonderful. So I mean, this is such a broad question, Anvita, and I'm going to ask you anyway. So what are some of the must-know sutras for a beginner? Because I know there's so much in this text and it's a lifetime of study. But if a beginner is looking at this text, according to you, what would be some of the sutras that they should absolutely know?
Excellent question. I think that if, you know, for an absolute beginner, starting with the very first chapter, I think knowing the definition and kind of why we're here, why are we studying the Yoga Sutras? I think number one, that's the most important. So we look at Yoga Sutra 1.2 and 1.3. 1.1, of course, is laying out why we're here. And it's kind of saying now begins the discipline of yoga. But when you look at the content itself, I think Sutra 1.2 is something I would highly recommend teachers to know, and not just to know, to have it at the back of your mind so you can recite it and keep reminding yourself of the definition. So Sutra 1.2 is Yoga Shchitta Vritti Nirodha. And this is such an important sutra because in just one statement, it gives us the definition of this entire practice, according to Muni Patanjali. And it helps us to understand that within the practice of yoga, we're essentially trying to identify our chitta vrittis and then lead them to an eventual restraint or a certain amount of stoppage or control over them. So this becomes very important because, you know, as we all know, today the definition of yoga has just become something else because of the way that it's being projected and the kind of images we see of yoga all over the place. So very often, you know, we'll have, and I'm sure you've experienced this, where there are students who will come to you and say that, oh, I can't do yoga because I'm not flexible.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And it's such a tragedy when you hear that, because that's so far away from the definition of yoga according to the sutra. And you have to keep then bringing it back to, but the definition itself is more about the thoughts. So your flexibility or lack of it has nothing to do with your ability to start the practice of yoga.
Mm-hmm. So true.
Yeah, I think once you're able to get that point across, then we're able to have this understanding that yoga is so much more than just the asanas or the pranayam or just, you know, the meditation elements. And that's why I think Sutra 1.2 is the first and the foremost important sutra to look into. And once you understand the meaning of that sutra and you really make that definition and internalize it, then your life changes forever because you never look at yoga the same way again. And so for any beginner, I would say starting with Sutra 1.2, then reading the Bhashya by, you know, Vyasa Bhashya, if you can look into that and see how it describes the different ways in which we can control the mind, how we need to use yoga as a tool for mind control rather than just a flexibility competition. And once we're able to do that, then we kind of change our overall perspective. So that's one, Sutra 1.2. And then I think the next one would be definitely Sutra 1.3, the one right after it, because that talks about basically what happens if you're able to still the thought waves of the mind. So it says, Tada drashtu svarupe vasthanam, which means that if you're able to restrain the thought waves of the mind and able to make your mind almost like a calm and still lake, then you will experience the seer within, or the drashta, as we call it, which is the witness. And that is what we're seeking. That's what we're trying to do when we practice yoga, is to come in contact or take on that witness position, so that we're not entangled in the realm of prakriti all the time, and we're able to take a step back, you know, whenever we need to, or whenever we, you know, just to create that ability to do that. So once a student or beginner understands that this is the immediate impact of going into yoga from a psychological perspective, then they can say, okay, fine. So it's not about me doing a handstand or headstand. It's about me taking a witness position and observing life instead of constantly being entangled with it. And that, I think, creates a huge impact, because then when you're studying yoga, when you're in an asana, when you're in even in life, you will have the tendency to go into observer mode, stay calm, stay relaxed, instead of constantly being agitated and wanting to engage with it. So that's why I think this combination of 1.2 and 1.3 is perhaps the most important combination to delve into. And it really sets up a beginner for much more advancement then going forward.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's beautifully explained. I just want to call out one thing for the listeners. The 1.2, the 1.3, the one is the chapter number. And the 0.2 and 0.3 that you hear is the verse number. Okay. And once you get into the sutras, this becomes common reference. So yeah, just in case somebody's like, what is 1.2, 1.3? So yeah, chapter and verse. That's how it's been numbered.
Yeah, thanks for that, Arunathi. I think that would definitely help clarify it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, sometimes, you know, I myself will be like, okay, you've got to remember that people are not nerding out about this all the time. So yeah, no, that was beautifully explained, 1.2 and 1.3. So where does someone go from there?
So once I think, you know, a student has understood this basic definition and the impact of what happens with that definition, then I think from there, it's important to start identifying the thought waves of the mind. So again, you know, one of the things, students who are listening in, when you start studying the Yoga Sutras, you just marvel at the way the text is structured, because it's such a logical, precise framework that right after Muni Patanjali explains this to us, he says, okay, fine. I told you that you need to restrain your thought waves, and that'll take you into a witness position. Now let me tell you what are the types of thought waves. And then he goes into explaining the exact types and different categories. And just for the listeners, you know, for their information, there's five different types of thought waves, specifically pramana, viparyaya, vikalpa, nidra, and smriti. Again, they might be words that you haven't heard before, but they refer to right knowledge, wrong knowledge, fanciful knowledge, and sleep or nidra, and memory. So basically, once you understand these different types of thought waves, you're able to see, okay, now how do I restrain them, or how do I gain mastery over them? Because the most logical thing is, if someone tells you, hey, you need to gain mastery over this, then the next logical step is, okay, what is that thing that I need to gain mastery over? What is its nature? What is its quality? How do I better understand it? And then once you have a good understanding of the nature of that thing, then you can start to create some mastery over it. So therefore, then Muni Patanjali takes us down that domain where he's like, okay, here is how the thoughts can be structured. And once he's laid out the structure of the thoughts, the next logical process is to tell you how to restrain them. So here is where we have to remember that he gives us two main techniques in the first chapter, which is abhyas and vairagya, also known as practice and detachment, or Ishwar Pranidhan, which is surrender to the divine. So whatever divinity that we might believe in. Now, these are the two main methods that Muni Patanjali prescribes in the first chapter. And like we discussed earlier, these are best suited to a practitioner who is adhimatra. So, you know, pretty well versed with yogic practices already in a way. But there are cases where you might introduce this to a beginner who just immediately takes to it and might, you know, hit it off with these methods and be able to go further. But that's a rare case. So we usually, you know, use these techniques for somebody that's a little more advanced.
Can I ask you a question there?
Yes.
Can you talk a little more about Abhyas and Vairagya? I ask this because it gets, at least out here, it gets thrown around very loosely. And it's used in situations where it's convenient to be used. So can you elaborate on what is Abhyas and what is Vairagya?
Okay, that's a very good question. And I see what you mean by it gets thrown around loosely because I've had similar experiences. And sometimes the words are so out of context that you have to almost correct the person and be like, hey, you know, that's not the right word to use in this scenario. So I totally understand that. So I think the most helpful thing will be for the definition of Abhyas, there's an incredible sutra 1.14. So from the first chapter, the 14th sutra, which I'll just get into explaining, that sutra helps us to understand the nature of this Abhyas or practice. So, okay. You know, generally we're thinking about practice, we're just, I'm just practicing something for an hour and that's my definition of a daily practice. I did my Abhyas and that's it, which is such a limited way to look at Abhyas. And a lot of people think that if they do a 1 hour yoga class in a day, then that's your Abhyas done for the day. Whereas I think the sutra of Abhyas, so I'll just recite the Sanskrit sutra and then I'll go into the words. So the sutra itself goes, sa tu dirgha kala nairantarya satkara sevito dridabhumihi. So this, now when you break it up and you say, okay, what do each of the words mean? They're saying that practice is, Abhyas is truly Abhyas when it's done for a long period of time with the same amount of dedication and devotion and the same amount of enthusiasm that was there in the beginning of the pursuit without any interruptions. So when you look at this definition of Abhyas, then you realize that Abhyas is a pretty much 24/7 kind of a concept. It really doesn't start and end at fixed points like that. And so I think once we're able to understand that, it's continuous. You know, otherwise we think that I'll just do yoga for a bit and that ends there. But if I say my yoga practice is my entire life or my everyday behavior, everything that I do, then we transcend just this loose meaning of a compartmentalized Abhyas into a lifelong sadhana of Abhyas and yogic practice. So I think that, you know, is a key understanding with the word Abhyas, along with the, you know, the thing that says no interruptions. Nairantarya. So usually we, even while practicing physical yoga, we'll have so many distractions even while doing it. And then if you look at philosophical yoga or living yoga as a lifestyle, there's just constantly so many disturbances, so many things that don't align with the yogic lifestyle that we keep bringing into our lives that take us away from the eventual goal that we're trying to reach. So I think that if you understand Abhyas from that perspective, then it becomes something that you will just do lifelong and not restrict to a particular moment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So true. And so important for us to recognize that, because we've spoken about this briefly earlier, right? These concepts just get plucked and just used according to something and it's just diluted. So I'm glad you explained it. What about Vairagya?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Vairagya and Abhyas are like, you know, two sides of the same coin. I'd also want to mention an amazing movie, actually, if you're listening and you're a beginner and some of these concepts sound a little difficult to understand, there's an amazing movie called Peaceful Warrior, which kind of depicts Abhyas and Vairagya in real life. So it's something my teacher asked me to watch when we were doing this. And then I'll explain why it helped to understand the concept more. So essentially, Vairagya is the practice of detachment in a way that when you're doing your practice or your abhyasa, you are not attached to the fruits or the results that will come from that practice. And I think in the modern day, you know, with social media, with this constant reward system that we now have, this is one of the hardest principles to practice. And I also want to say this, especially for us as yoga teachers and in yoga teachers in training, is that we're so used to Instagram and the dopamine hit that we get from the likes,
yes,
you know, and the comments and the followers, that it almost becomes like we'll create content just to have that reward. And it makes us go haywire with the practice of Abhyasa and Vairagya, because then we're not necessarily creating content for its authenticity, its quality, its nature, but we're creating it for the numbers to stack up and for us to feel a heightened sense of importance, you know? So I think that in this space, if we look at Vairagya detachment with this example of, let's say, Instagram or social media, I think that it's about authentically speaking your truth or authentically sharing information or value that you can add without worrying too much about, you know, the numbers. Are my numbers increasing? Am I constantly getting that validation or the number of likes increasing? This is not to say that we shouldn't grow our businesses or we shouldn't try to expand, but I think the over obsession with the...
Yes.
You know, just like, because then what happens is you get into a vicious cycle of, if your abhyasa is not leading to enough of a fruit, then you doubt the abhyasa itself.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then you interpret it anyhow you want.
Yeah, literally. You start to think that maybe what I'm doing is wrong to begin with. So why do it? And it takes you down a rabbit hole of self-doubt and questioning your own practice, your own dedication. And I think it takes us off track. Then we kind of lose sight of what was important in the first place. So I think that in, you know, in this domain, especially, Vairagya is the practice of saying, hey, I will do the process in as dedicated a manner as I possibly can. And I will, you know, strive for perfection in that space. And then I will put my content or put my best efforts out there and surrender to the result that has to come to me, because I believe in the sincerity of my process. And I know that if the process is sincere, whatever has to come my way will come my way eventually. Mm-hmm. So I think that helps us to have a certain dissociation from hankering after the fruits of our efforts, and just keeps us a little more mentally peaceful with these things overall. And I will add here, especially with Vairagya, you know, actually 2 years ago, I'd done an experiment with Vairagya because I really wanted to see how can I play it out in real life. And so 2 years ago, I decided to go bald as a practice of Vairagya to see that when you lose the attachment to your hair or to, you know, certain prakritic elements of yourself, what does that do to you? And how does that influence your personality? So I think from a personal experience, I can say that doing that experiment in Vairagya helped me to realize that all these things externally, the hair, the awards, and all of that is not as relevant as your day-to-day interaction with yourself and how you conduct your abhyasa and practice. So once you take away these external kind of things that inflate your ego a little bit, you really come down to the core of things, and you come down to what is really important and how do I improve on that day by day instead of worrying about the result all the time. So yeah, I would say that that's what Vairagya essentially is.
Beautifully explained. And so I know I cut you off with Abhyasa and Vairagya. So we've spoken about, say, three sutras. Okay. Would you want to add anything more? I know you have an extensive YouTube channel and all the sutras, which I can't wait to tell the listeners about in a bit. But do you want to add more here or do you want to move on?
Sure. I think there's one or two more sutras that I'd love to mention here.
Sure. Go for it.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, so these sutras help us to kind of understand the mind, help us to see some techniques that we can use to overcome certain thought waves and certain tendencies of the mind. But I think along with that, within the first chapter, again, there's an excellent sutra on how to create a conducive environment for the mind. So I think this is an important one because we constantly talk about, okay, restrain your thought waves, create the right practices. But what happens if the environment within your mind is not conducive to begin with for those practices to be harnessed? So in this Sutra 1.33, there's an amazing explanation of how you should engage with the external world and your interpersonal relationships in order to have a conducive environment of the mind to help you on the yoga path. So this sutra, I remember studying it when we were 15, and when my teacher taught it to us, I was like, wow, why don't we learn more of this? Because it tells us that depending on the type of person that you interact with, your attitude towards them should be cultivated in a particular way. So say, for example, you come across somebody that is extremely virtuous, right? So has excellent talents, amazing qualities. Our usual human tendency is to feel a little bit insecure and jealous because we think that, you know, maybe I'm lacking something or
exactly.
How come they are so good at that? Like, is something wrong with me? But I think this sutra tells us to cultivate mudita, which is a certain amount of joy towards such a person, because the fact that they've cultivated an excellent trait is amazing. It's something that we should look up to, aspire for, and work towards more instead of feeling insecure or sort of challenged by it. So I think that this is an excellent trait or combination that the sutra describes for us, where it says, if you want to have a peaceful state of mind, be mindful of your interactions with other people, specific types of people, and what kind of emotions you're cultivating towards them. So it says mudita towards somebody that is virtuous. It says indifference to somebody that, you know, has done you wrong or is constantly trying to pull you down. So cultivating a certain amount of indifference towards them, along with happiness towards, friendliness towards those who are happy, and compassion towards those that might not be as fortunate or as well off as us. So I think that even though it sounds like pretty easy to understand virtues and traits, I think the way it gets laid out in the sutra helps us to see that even our basic interpersonal relationships and how we conduct them will play a huge role in the conduciveness of our mind for these deeper yogic practices. So I think this is, you know, one of the sutras that I would 10 on 10 recommend studying and learning more about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, while a lot of this sounds like simplistic, not that all of it sounds simplistic, I'm just saying this particular one, it's really living it in every moment. Mm-hmm. Right. And to make it our second nature, which is where I think there's a lot of gap, where a lot of people who study these texts that I have seen, it's an external thing. Embodying this is where the problem is, because we try to speed learn our way through a lot of these things. So
absolutely.
I'm really glad you mentioned that. So what would be your final one for this conversation?
I think my final one would be Sutra, I think 2.28, which is an amazing sutra because in just one concise and clear sentence, it encapsulates all the different eight limbs of Ashtanga Yoga. And I think just a little bit of a mention of this is important because this, when we look at the Yam, Niyam, Asan, Pranayam, Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi, the eight different limbs of yoga, I think that there's a lot of overemphasis on certain spaces and lack of emphasis on others. And I know that you also did an amazing episode on the Yam Niyam and, you know, talking more about that.
Yes.
And I think that that sutra becomes so important because it lays out in a great order of sequence where our focus and attention should fall when we're doing the practical sadhana of yoga. And I think that the more we study that particular sutra, memorize it and learn it, we're able to see that without the Yam Niyam as the foundational elements to our asana, pranayam and pratyahara practice, we're unable to sustain the discipline that's required to move into those deeper realms. And at the same time, when we see dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, and we see how those three come together, we can see that these form what we call sanyam, the antaranga yoga triad, where that's essentially what, when we say meditation, we're referring to dharana, dhyana, and samadhi as three different processes, and how that will then lead us into deeper realms of understanding the mind and taking a step back and going into the witness principle. So I think that the reason I say 2.28 is because, again, it's a very concise, easy to remember sutra, but it's so important because it lays out the exact order of importance and priority that we should place while we're studying yoga. Because very often we tend to just, you know, shop around within the Ashtanga Yoga and just pick up whichever limbs we think are the most beneficial and then go with that. But this sutra kind of reminds us that there's an order to things, or there's a certain way in which things should be done so that they result in the goal that we're trying to achieve. And so just keeping that order of things in mind and remembering the eight different limbs and not separating one for the other helps us to keep focus and stay consistent with our practice.
That's wonderful. And to be honest, Anvita, I can like keep asking you questions about one more sutra and one more sutra, but I would love for you to tell the listeners about your YouTube channel, which is how I discovered you. And I know you have sutra by sutra videos there, and it's really well done. And you make it so much easier for a lot of us who are trying to understand this topic. So can you tell us a little bit about your intention behind creating the YouTube channel? Because hardly anybody creates a YouTube channel about the Yoga Sutras. You know? And I know you do more than the sutras. I know there's more in there. But can you tell us a little more about your channel, where people can connect with you, where they can learn from you and everything?
Sure. I think that's, yeah, definitely. I remember we were talking even before this, that it's such a niche domain or a niche space to be in. And I think so. Our YouTube channel is called Yogic Gurukul. And the reason I particularly wanted to focus on the Yoga Sutras is because I just felt like there's such a gap in the way yoga is projected and taught and consumed today that it kind of, there's a huge separation from what was originally intended versus what is being cultivated and taught more popularly today. And I just felt like if we can bridge that gap between, you know, why does the Yoga Sutra or any of the ancient Indian textbooks, why do they have to be shrouded in mystery and just difficult to understand and something that's, you know, a task to take on? I just felt like I wanted to create a strong content bank that I wanted to last for years so that, you know, if anybody is struggling or they're wondering, what does this sutra mean? What does that one mean? There's like one place you can go to. And you can trust that in 10 minutes, at least you'll have a basic understanding of what that sutra is trying to communicate. And I also try to be very clear in, you know, in my videos and even in general, is that those sutras and those videos are intended to be like your starting point or something that helps you to kickstart your journey, but never as a replacement to studying with an actual guru or studying with somebody that is face-to-face with you. So I try my best to make it as simple as possible so that as many people as possible can find it fun, find it engaging, find it relatable. And then it sort of piques their interest in a way that they're like, okay, this is exciting. I want to learn more about it. So that's sort of the intention with the channel. And I feel it came to me because I lived and grew up in a yoga institution, and I had, I think, the good fortune of being surrounded by yoga teachers and philosophers from a very young age. And I noticed how they would constantly reference the Patanjali Yoga Sutras as, you know, the main text, the book from where all the yogic knowledge comes, at least in terms of the psychology domain. And I just felt like this is something I've seen all my life in the yoga institution, but it's just not there when I go into the external world. And it was such a huge gap that there was an itch within me that I have to do something and I have to bridge this gap because it doesn't feel right if I don't even try. So it kind of came from a deep desire to bridge the gap and to share with people the love of philosophy, because it changed my life when I studied it, you know, 10, 15 years back. And it really shaped me into the person I am today. So I wanted to find a way to share that love and to show people that philosophy is not just something that's within a book and sometimes you read it, but it can really become a living science, a living practice. If you put those principles and you really try to apply them, it can just make you the best version of yourself. So why would you not do it? You know, and that's kind of where the intention was.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am glad you did it, because I can absolutely say that it is tremendously helpful.
Thank you.
Because so many times, right, yoga teachers are just, we're bouncing from one book to the next book to the next course. And I always believe this, the seeker is sincere, right? And it really comes down to who they're interacting with or what they're interacting with and what they're learning. So I think your Yogic Gurukul YouTube channel is tremendously, it's truly a gift to all the yoga students who are trying to understand the sutras more. I will make sure to link to this and everything else that you do in our show notes. I hope, Anvita, that you will be back for more such conversations. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Arundhati. I think it was such a pleasure talking to you, and I had such a great time going into the Yoga Sutras deeply. So thank you for having me, and I look forward to being back on a future episode.
Wonderful. Thank you. As always, thank you so much for listening to the Let's Talk Yoga podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please remember to review, rate, and like the Let's Talk Yoga podcast. It always means the world to us when you leave us a little review and share this with a yoga friend of yours, and help spread the knowledge that is available via this podcast to all around you. Once again, my teaching yoga course to beginners, the details are at mindfulyogateachers.com/YTT. I'll be back next week with another guest, another conversation. Until then, take care. Bye-bye.